En podcast fra Podplay.
3, 2, 1. When lift off.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Enter bed. Okay, we checked all four systems, and there you go on modulation, all four, and keying with a go.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Professor Brian Cox, thank you so much for joining Romkapsel. Just a small few days before you go on stage with your show Horizons in Oslo, in Oslo Spektrum, the big venue. This is like the revenge of the nerds, isn't it, Brian?
Yeah. I mean, this tour has been going on for a year now or more. And it is. It's a rock and roll tour. I mean, in the UK, you know, we played arenas 14,000-15,000 people. We had enormous. You know, I don't know if you know, but I began life as a musician, and I dreamt of having a tour where we had more than. I don't know what the vans are called in Oslo. We had a transit van, you know, a little tiny little van.
And
I dreamt of having a tour with big, huge lorries. And then on this tour, yeah, indeed, we had 5 trucks and 2 crew buses. And I thought my 20-year-old self in music would have been so pleased. So I spent quite a time, you know, wandering around with the crew, just going, yes, this is finally I've made it. But I didn't make it play music. So I decided to talk about the origin of the universe and the nature of space-time instead. And that seems to have done the trick. But it is, you know, it's a show that was designed for arenas. And indeed in Oslo, you know, we have the LED screens and so pretty much the arena show that we had in the UK. Because I think astronomy lends itself to, as well as deep ideas and challenging questions, it also lends itself to spectacle, because the images from obviously Hubble, but also the JWST, and even actually the rather slightly blurry images of black holes from the Event Horizon Telescope look magnificent when you put them on big LED screens in big arenas.
They do. And
yeah, I was thinking about that, Brian, because a show of this size, it has to be planned, and it has to be planned a good while in advance. And then comes James Webb Telescope and finds new things that will kind of trip up the things that you've already planned on. Are you cross with James Webb?
No, I love it because I put them in. So I stress my video people out hugely because I turn up in the afternoon when they've spent all day building these screens and setting everything up. And I go, I've just got a new image. I want to put this in. And they go, oh, no, really? You know, so they've got used to it now. But that to me, energizes me, you know, the fact that I can talk about new ideas. I mean, in the show now, so I started on the European part of the tour 2 days ago in Brussels. And I put in a whole new section about Europa because I've been filming for a new BBC series, and we made which is one of the films is about Europa Clipper. And so I'd just been filming and learned a huge amount about the motivation behind Europa Clipper and the story, the intricate story of Europa and why it might be a potential home for life. And I got so interested in it that I put it in the show last night.
This is one of the things I've always loved about astronomy. I mean, ever since I studied it back in the 1980s, it's been like this all the time. For instance, when I took my master's, the Voyager probes were heading out into the solar system. So we had sort of our curriculum was rewritten on the fly because we learned one thing. And then there was a space probe that said, no, it's not like that at all. You have volcanoes around Jupiter, for instance, and you have geysers around Neptune, and that's one of the things I really love, and I also think one of the parts that the audience loves, because I guess they expect you to be updated, right? I mean, if you find something new about from the Webb telescope, they do expect to see it in the show.
Yes, absolutely, and as you say, the I'd also we've been making some films about Pluto the New Horizons mission to Pluto.
Oh, yeah.
And it's interesting that, you know, what I spoke to, when you speak to the scientists on that mission, nobody, they're fairly confident that you know, you can always look back in the scientific literature and find that somebody guessed something about 30 years ago and they'll claim they discovered it. But the idea of nitrogen glaciers on Pluto, I don't think anyone really thought that you would have nitrogen glaciers that flow in the same way that water ice glaciers flow here on Earth. And it's kind of obvious in hindsight, because what you have there is solid nitrogen, but very close to its melting point on Pluto. Right. And so the behavior of the material is similar to water ice close to its melting point here on Earth. But nobody thought of it. And one of the scientists said to me that the thing, every time you go into the outer solar system or you get to a new place, Pluto, or as you said, in terms of Voyager, the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, you find that nature's imagination exceeds our own. So nature will make interesting places in, in regions. Yeah,
that's so true. We just made an episode about JUICE, ESA's Jupiter probe, which is supposed to be the companion of Europa Clipper. And then I had to research Ganymede and Callisto, which are also really interesting moons, which we also know very little about. So again, I'm just expecting that in the early 2030s, we will see some really astonishing things from Jupiter and also from Saturn with that huge thing that's going to fly around on Titan, a nuclear-powered drone that's going to land on Titan. I love this science.
Yeah, well, I mean, Europa, you know, the as one of the big questions with Clipper and JUICE that they're designed to answer is whether material from the surface can get into the ocean below. And it's strongly suspected it can. But the geology is interesting because you're talking about, 40 kilometers of ice, maybe more. And the amount of energy required to essentially have plate tectonic-like behavior on that moon, which is observed, is enormous. And it's not... As in my conversations with the Europa Clipper scientists, there are different theories for how that energy is stored up and then released in order to make the ice behave the way that it behaves, really to fracture that much ice in a way that it seems you can get material from the surface into the ocean. And so that's a wonderful thing, isn't it? We don't even know the mechanism by which the geology that we observe on the surface is proceeding. And you would think, you'd think we'd know that. It's just ice.
Yeah.
But it behaves in such a strange way in that particular environment, with that particular orbit and the interaction with Io and so on in particular. It's difficult.
Yeah.
But excuse me for one second. We have had several of these kinds of talks on our podcast, and I always say that, I get a headache from thinking about this because the questions are so big. The universe is so vast. And then you stand there on the big stage on TV and on every Discovery program ever has had a segment of Brian Cox in it. And what does that do to your mind thinking about these things 24/7?
Well, I don't think about it all the time. I think about what wine to order and things like that as well.
You wouldn't need that.
Yeah. But I think the most challenging thing that I talk about, and I'm not sure I've found absolutely the right way to talk about it yet, it is black holes, because that's what I've become interested in. And when you talk about geology and the search for life, at least there's a simple story to tell, a simple motivation. But with black holes, I've tried to make television programs about the black hole information paradox and what we know about black holes and the emergent space-time. And I'm going to talk about all these things in the live show. And I don't think I've ever successfully made one yet. I don't think I've quite found the way. So it changes quite a lot in the live show, actually. So what you'll see is me trying to compress papers, work that's been done now, so 2019, 2020, 2021, into some kind of intelligible format on the stage. So there is a section of that, which I would call experimental. It's like experimental theatre. It's almost avant-garde, as I'm trying to talk about, you know. How a black hole could store information, how information can be conserved and get out of the black hole and become imprinted in the Hawking radiation. And it's not very visual. That's the problem with making television shows about it.
For a feeble mind like mine, it's extremely difficult to grasp even a fraction of the things that you scientists know about black holes. And also, I think what you think you know about black holes, because they are, for one, scary and then extremely fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, we are now entering a period of time when black hole study is experimental, because we have the Event Horizon Telescope, but also the gravitational wave detectors, LIGO, Virgo. And so we have data now for the first time on black hole collisions and the images from the radio telescopes of black holes. But I think that what's interesting is that if you look at the history, and I talk about this in the live show, back to 1974, you know, the original papers by Stephen Hawking and Bekenstein and others. What you have is fundamental physics that we're pretty sure we understand. And the really interesting thing about black holes, well, amongst the many interesting things, is that the event horizon is a region of space-time where we expect to understand the physics. So that there shouldn't be anything that our quantum mechanics, essentially basic quantum mechanics and relativity, can't deal with at the event horizon. And that's why it's become so interesting, because initially, when you go back to the papers through the 70s and 80s and all the way through to now, actually, applying that basic physics in a region where it should work has produced apparent paradoxes. And that's why they're so interesting, actually. So we're not talking about the singularity where nobody knows and it's all very complicated and you need a quantum theory of gravity and so on. It's actually the event horizon, which is somewhere where we should be able to describe the physics.
On the other hand, that's when science gets interesting, right? That's when you expect to see one thing and then you see something completely different. And then you know that this is an area which excites scientists. That's sort of... And that's one of the things that sometimes can be hard to convey, that uncertainty or surprise or a lack of an explanation is actually a good thing in science. It's when we know everything, it's cool. Yeah, that's when it gets exciting. That's what really turns scientists on. And sort of conveying that, I think you're very good at doing that, conveying that excitement of actually not knowing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned it at the end of the show, I as you probably get the impression, I kind of ad-lib through it somewhat. But usually I talk about Richard Feynman, one of my favorite essays from 1955 called The Value of Science. And sometimes I read some of it out, actually. And in there, you know, he talks about what the most valuable thing is about science. And you might, you know, the obvious things to say, which, and it's true, are that science lies at the very foundation of our civilization. So obviously we all think about medical science and communications and now our cell phones, all that stuff. But actually he says in that essay, the most valuable thing is that the embracing of doubt, and he calls science in that essay, he defines it as a satisfactory philosophy of ignorance, which is a beautiful definition. And he says that's the true value. I remember the words he writes. He says that we as scientists have a responsibility to communicate how doubt is not to be feared but welcomed and discussed. And that's the foundation of not only science, actually, but also democracy, as he points out in that essay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. And also, when you mentioned Feynman, I've also read that essay Well, if you want a sort of solid grounding in physics, his lectures, the Feynman lectures on physics are still very, very good. They're out there. And you can, I think you might even go to YouTube and listen to them, but they're really great. So if you want to sort of understand physics from the bottom up, go listen to Feynman. He's still very, very relevant. And he was also a very good sort of to tell the story of science.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Feynman lectures, you're absolutely right. He, you know, you've probably spoken about the story before, but he decided to build a whole course in physics from the ground up and went back and learned it himself, just relearned the whole.
Yeah, right.
So it's his view. And the thing I always remember in the Feynman lectures is I'm always getting asked in these TV shows and things to explain tides. I mean, we're talking about Europa, right? So the reason saltwater ocean on Europa, liquid water, is because of tidal heating. And so tides. And then and always when you do it on television, the television executive says, let's do tides. And I say, are you really sure? Because it's not as simple as you think it is. And they go, yes, let's do it. And then Feynman points out in the Feynman lectures, I love the section on tides, because he says, you can't explain them just by, you know, usually you say, oh, well, the moon and the earth are there and there's one side of the moon and there's stronger gravity and less sided. There's less gravity, or whatever, across the earth and the moon, actually. There's less gravity on one side and more on the other. And so it kind of stretches out and you get the tides. And it's, of course, Feynman points out that if you consider just a static model, if you just say, well, here's the earth and here's the moon and there's a bit more gravity on one side than the other, then the moon and the earth had just smashed into each other. If they're just being pulled together by gravity, you've got to know they're rotating around each other. They're orbiting around the common center of mass. And so he goes in some detail into how tides, there's a centrifugal term and there's a gravitational term and and it's brilliant, right? It's a magnificent explanation of the tides. And so what Feynman always does, and he said that, I think there's an interview on YouTube, as you said, where he says, you can't be too simple, right? If you oversimplify, then nobody has any chance of understanding it because you've not given them enough information. So there is a level at which you've got to get to a certain level before you can provide a satisfactory explanation of virtually anything.
But isn't that, I think you're touching on something extremely important when it comes to conveying the topics that you work with, and also at some level what we do is the ability to make something extremely difficult understandable, but understandable enough and make it complicated enough to still be fascinating. And you do that very well.
Well, thank you. I mean, the reason is, I think, one thing I've learned is that I'm quite slow in being a physicist in learning things, because I really want to understand from the ground up. And Feynman said this as well. He said, I think the easiest person to kid is yourself, right? So you can easily trick yourself into thinking you really understand something. And so because I'm quite slow when I want to explain something in a book or on television, I go back to first principles for my own benefit so that I make sure I understand it. And very often I find out that I didn't really understand it properly. A very good example is I've just written a book with a colleague of mine, Jeff Forshaw, on black holes. Yeah. And because we became fascinated, and we share a PhD student now who's working on black holes and quantum information. And the thing that was wonderful to me about writing the book was the thermodynamics. So really basic undergraduate thermodynamics, like what is entropy and what is temperature and where did those concepts come from and how have they evolved and how do they transfer over to quantum theory and those things. And I really loved, to the point of actually, I want to teach it now. I want to do introductory thermodynamics at Manchester and teach that lecture course, because it was so fascinating to me that, you know, and obviously you learn it when you're an undergraduate, but I just hadn't appreciated the elegance and depth of the subject at all when I was an undergraduate. And it was going back to try and talk about black holes that I realized what an amazing subject thermodynamics is.
1202.
But there is a sort of fractal structure to science in that way. I mean, you can delve into any part of science and you will find something new, and you will, and we haven't even talked about the history of science, because that's another huge subject and another sort of a wellspring of information you can talk about. So that's also one of the really interesting and giving things about and conveying science is that there's always more. There's always some area, as you say, you can sort of dig deeper and then you find something, and you find something about the subject or about the people who researched the subject previously, which usually are also very interesting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, thermodynamics is a great example, because if you look at the subject being developed through the 19th century, at the turn of the 20th century, people were still arguing about the existence of atoms. Right? So that, even that wasn't accepted when people like Boltzmann were essentially discovering a theory of the moving parts of matter, right? The, you know, statistical physics. And there's still the arguments were going on. And it's really the parallel between that and black hole research today is really interesting, because, you know, Stephen Hawking discovered that black holes have a temperature. And then Bekenstein and others calculated and discovered they have an entropy. Well, in the 19th century, that argument, those quantities existed in physics, and they were telling us that matter is made of atoms. They were telling us that these ideas of temperature have a deeper explanation in terms of moving parts of matter, moving parts of things. And we now know what those moving parts are. With a black hole, the pure description of a black hole is just space-time in general relativity in Einstein's. Just space-time. That's it, geometry. But it has a temperature and it stores information. And so the strong implication is that we're at the same point now as we were in the 19th century when we're talking about matter. Like, we're talking about building blocks of space-time. Mm. And we don't know what they are, but in our book we say, you know, really what that research is telling us is general relativity is a statistical theory, in the same way that in the 19th century we're arguing about the structure of matter. And that's really the modern way of thinking about black holes. That's why they're so interesting.
Yeah. Hmm.
Returning to black holes. And did you have some questions that we've received over and stored that we might now get the proper answer to?
I think basically that all our questions on black holes have been answered. But, I mean, you pose other questions as well. I mean, black holes is just part of your show. Also, you talk about, right, the universe, how it came to be, and what came before the universe, which is a question that you tend to get if you have any sort of dealings with astrophysics. Usually, when you meet people, they say, okay, the universe was... Once there was nothing, and then there was everything, matter, time, space. But what came before? I mean, there must have been something before. I met a guy just a few days ago who had that exact question. He said, but there must have been some sort of natural law that allows for the creation of universes. You can't just have nothing that turns to something, he said. And that's what's your take on this? Because it seems that this, you seem to imply that you talk about this as well.
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is, as we said before, the correct answer is we don't know.
Yeah, right.
And show finished. Thank you. Goodbye. Thank you for coming.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, so I was referring to the theory of inflation, right? So if you're careful and redefine the Big Bang as what we now call the hot Big Bang, which is the time when the universe was very hot and very dense, and we have a measurement back to when that was, which is 13.8 billion years, give or take. And so we do strongly suspect that there was something before the universe was hot and dense. And I think strongly suspect is probably the right thing to say. And it's a very well-established theory called inflation. So the universe was, space-time was there, expanding very quickly. And then that expansion slows down. And essentially collapses. And the energy that was driving that expansion, which has got a fancy name, it's called the inflaton field, but it doesn't matter what it is, it's something driving it. It changes state and gets dumped into space and heats it up and makes the particles out of which we are made. And so that's a theory that's the textbook, the standard theory against which I think observation is, or that's the theory that we challenge by observations of things like the cosmic microwave background radiation and so on. But that doesn't tell you anything about what a friend of mine, Carlos Frank at Durham University, calls the mother of all Big Bangs. So even if there are multiple Big Bangs, we have this thing called the inflationary multiverse and lots of little bubble universes. The question still arises, as you said, well, how did the whole thing start? And I honestly, now I've come to think recently that in the study of black holes, really we're beginning to be led to this idea of what is often called emergent space-time. So space-time is coming from something else. And the something else appears to be quantum entanglement, the entanglement of something, some kind of underlying quantum theory that produces space and time. So I think that we need to understand that before we can even talk in terms of a beginning. Because, I mean, really, put simply, we don't know what time is. So if you don't know what time is, it seems to me to talk with any authority at all about a beginning of time makes no sense because we don't know what it is. But we're going to get, that Sean Carroll wrote a very good book about this called Something Deeply Hidden. And I quote that in my show. That's a beautiful phrase that Einstein coined, that if you pay attention to nature very carefully, you can catch a glimpse of something deeply hidden, which is the deep structure of nature. And I think that's what we're beginning to see with this idea of emergent space-time, that there's something below it. There's something underlying space and time. And I think he argues, Sean Carroll actually argues that if you take a purely quantum picture of a universe, then, you could argue it needs to be eternal. It's probably eternal, but probably too strong. But so maybe there isn't a beginning. I think that's the...
Here we just have to interject and say, on behalf of our listeners who heard you say, we don't know what time is. And I said, but what is it we're measuring then? I mean, we see that time passes, we have clocks. So what is that if we don't know what time is?
Yeah, we have clocks. I'm going to name drop actually now because I asked Kip Thorne this question because
that's a big name drop.
Name drop because you want to if you look at relativity, then a clock is hard with a theory like that to say what are the actual basic things that you need, what are the inputs into that theory. But I think, and your listeners might, if they're expert listeners, we could have a debate, but I think the existence of a clock is fundamental to that theory. I think it's an assumption that there are such things as clocks. And from there, you can build the theory. So, yeah, and then, you could talk about the quantum mechanical relationship between frequency and energy. And I think that the existence of clocks is an axiom. Oh, what would you say? I mean, that's what I think. I think that's what I would argue. But that's not to say that's in those theories. That's not to say that there's a deeper explanation for what time is. But I don't think we have it.
Many years of study in the universities have now had a quite elevated debate. I would just insert a question from the common man right now. When people come up to you, Brian, and tell you, oh, I'm a big fan, but I drink too much red wine thinking about the stuff that you say, what do they say to you? What are the feedbacks you get from, let me use that word in the biggest sense, regular people?
I think science gives you, thinking about science gives you permission to think about things beyond yourself, doesn't it? To think about big questions. And I think I use that word, I think sometimes people think, you need a little bit of is permission the right word? Encouragement to say that you can. It's legitimate to think, what does it mean that there are 400 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy and 2 trillion galaxies in the observable universe, and maybe the universe is infinite extent in extent beyond that horizon. You know, I think sometimes people think, well, that's too frightening. I don't want to think about it. I'm just going to, like you said, have a glass of red wine. But the idea that you can ask those questions, and there is actually an intellectual process by which we're trying to answer them. Yeah, you know, that there is a framework there. So it's not just sitting there sort of dreaming about things and getting confused and frightened and then thinking about something else. That science provides a framework by which we can approach those enormous questions. And we don't have the answers yet, but at least we have a framework to sit there and think about the questions. Actually, there's a friend of mine, actually, I've got a friend who is he's retired now, but he was the dean of the cathedral in Guildford. It's this big cathedral. And I asked him once, you know, what do you think about your cathedral? And he said, well, first of all, it's a place that people can go, and that by its very scale, by the existence of this thing, it should just force you or help you think about something else. And it doesn't really matter what it is. You know, he's the Church of England. They kind of don't really believe much at all, right? Yeah. So it's very liberal. but he said, you know, I don't really care what it is. You know, I just think that I'm in Berlin at the moment. You know, I went to the cathedral yesterday. It's an incredible building. And the first thing is, it's just an expression of our desire to know something, to make some sense of existence, isn't it? And I think science is that. So you can think of science as that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the things that I really like about the way you talk about science, is that you are not afraid of posing questions like this and putting, in some ways, putting humans at the center of it. For instance, the point that we exist, the point that we can observe the universe, our role, the fact that sometimes when we talk about universe, we tend to talk about humans just as specks of dust on an average planet around an average star in an average galaxy. And then if you talk about it that way, you will often see people, listeners, say, but isn't there something special about this? Isn't there something special about existence and intelligence and observation and the ability to reflect on our position in the universe? And I really like that you, for instance, you say that, what is the significance of this, right? The significance of life in the cosmos and observers. And these are not just questions that entertain the listeners and sort of tickle their imaginations. They're also important questions, right?
Yeah. There's the great book on this, in my view, is a book called The Anthropic Cosmological Principle.
Yeah, I wrote that in my notes. We need to put a touch on that, yeah.
Yeah, I love that book. It was one of the books I bought when I was an undergraduate, and I just love it to this day. And it's quite, you know, it goes into some, I think, pretty wild speculation at the end. But, you know, in particular, John Barrow is a great hero of mine, wonderful cosmologist and a deep thinker. And that book really does. It puts humans not at the center of the universe, but it is possible to think about life. Life is a physical property of the universe. Mm. And I think it's legitimate to ask the question, well, what is it important? Could life, in the Anthropic Cosmological Principle, that book, they imagine this thing called the final anthropic principle, where life in the very far future becomes increasingly important in the evolution of the universe. And it's very speculative, but it's interesting. And I noticed, actually, I read an article a couple of days ago that I think there's a new book being written by one of Stephen Hawking's collaborators that was kind of with Stephen initially, which seems to be more anthropic in its approach to cosmology. Oh. I read about that a couple of days ago, so maybe it's about to come out. But I think that it's not illegitimate to think about life in a cosmological context at all. There's a long history of it. Mm. Some very good physicists.
Yeah. And also, I mean, the converse, thinking about a universe completely devoid of life and devoid of observers. That's, I mean, that's sort of this, the simplified version of this for our listeners is that the old philosophical problem that if a big tree falls in a forest and nobody hears it fall, has it even fallen, right? And yeah. And if a universe exists without any observers, just pure physics and no life, does it even exist? This is sort of an extreme or simplified version of it.
Yeah, and it'd certainly be completely meaningless.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, but I mentioned this in the show. Whatever meaning is, we talk about meaning, what it means to be alive. Whatever it is, it's a property of conscious beings, right? It's clearly here on this planet, in this little corner of the universe. It's a property of brains, brains of complex creatures, and really arguably humans, right?
So
that, you know, and we can argue about how sentient different animals are, but at least complex animals with brains. And so if you remove brains and complex life, you remove meaning. And I ask the question, I talk about it in the live show, you know, what do we know about the probability that a galaxy such as the Milky Way has more than one civilization, or we know it has one. What do we know? How far out into the universe would you have to go to find another one? And we don't know, of course, but we can sort of speculate that there's some things we know about the history of the evolution of life on Earth that allow us to make at least an educated guess. And I point out that if it is true that civilizations are very rare. And again, I mentioned Sean Carroll before. He's a good friend of mine. I asked him once, "What on average, how many civilizations do you think there are in a galaxy?" And he said, "None." Zero. So if that's true, then, you know, we might be the only island of meaning in a sea of 400 billion suns. And I think that's not a scientific thing to say.
Yeah, that's interesting because it sort of, it partly solved the not paradoxical Fermi paradox, the fact that the universe seems quite quiet at the moment.
Yeah.
And it might be, as you say, as simple as there are billions of galaxies, even if there on average is one civilization per galaxy, you could have a universe full of civilizations, but they are so far apart and moving apart so fast that they might never be able to communicate with another. That's one possible solution to this that we, I mean, I grew up in the 70s and I remember reading, for instance, all the papers that were published back then, written by folk like Carl Sagan and his collaborators, that more or less expected to receive some kind of signal pretty soon. They were planning for that. And it never happened. And when we listen now, you have Breakthrough Listen, for instance, they are processing billions of signals and they sometimes find interesting stuff, but it always turns out to be something natural. And of course, the extreme version of that is that we actually are alone, the only one in the whole universe. But the other one is that it might simply be rare, or intelligence might be rare, right? And you could have a galaxy full of green slime, but they never moved beyond that. They never crawled on land for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll name drop again. I had the real honor of spent a whole day with Frank Drake filming him at his house.
And I would just have to interject there. He's the grandfather of all this, right? Looking for signals from space. He started it all. Yeah, great, great man.
Yeah. He drove, you know, the Arecibo message, the famous message that was sent to the Arecibo telescope. And then he said to me, you know, that he thought that when he pioneered SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and using radio telescopes when they first became available. We have to remember, we didn't really have radio telescopes till the 50s or 60s, right. You know, the 50s, I guess. And he thought that the moment he started listening with the first radio telescopes, he would hear the conversations of civilization and carried on throughout his career. And he died a few years ago now. But he said he wasn't disappointed. He just realized it was more difficult than he'd imagined. But to what you said, he also collects and breeds orchids, rare orchids. And just it happened that the day I went to his house, there was an orchid that flowers for one day a year. And it was
flowering. Yeah.
And he showed me this orchid. And he said, you know, perhaps this is the way with civilizations. Perhaps they're really widely scattered. And also they just rise and fall so quickly in cosmic time that they just don't overlap. And it was just this most beautiful thing because this orchid did that. So he said, you know, any other day that you come to my house, you would not see the orchid flower, but just on this one day. Maybe civilizations are like that.
1202.
But that's also, I think that's also a very good example of how physical science, listening for signals, can actually tell us something about the nature of civilizations, right? Because if you go back again to the papers from the 70s, you will see that there are these really big ideas about how civilizations appear, how they might develop, what might end them, the average life cycle, which I'm not a historian, but I read a lot of history, and I don't see those kinds of reflections, except for Jared Diamond. He started to write about it. But I recognize his thoughts again about the rise and fall of civilizations from astrophysics. I thought that was so interesting that they were back then, they were thinking about, again, the nature of intelligent, of observers, and the role that might have for the universe.
Yeah. Yeah. It's another, so we talked about Richard Feynman, that essay, yeah. The Value of Science, came really partly from his experience on the Manhattan Project. And Oppenheimer actually is really interesting. I mean, there's the new film at the moment, isn't there? The Chris Nolan film about Oppenheimer. But he delivered the BBC Reith Lectures. So these are really like famous lectures the BBC delivers every year or enables them to happen. And Oppenheimer did them in 1953. And he spoke about the same thing. He spoke about the idea that we have acquired knowledge as a civilization that exceeds our wisdom. So he was very surprised, Feynman was as well, that he was alive in the 50s, because he thought that the atomic bomb was so powerful that we wouldn't be able to control it. And the jury's still out, by the way. And they were worried before the Cuban Missile Crisis that they were writing this stuff in the 50s. So they thought that maybe there is a natural limit to how long a technological civilization can exist, because it just basically, we are very good at science and engineering and very bad at politics. Is basically
the point. That's very true. I mean, you always have this. Yes, we've sort of handled nuclear weapons as a technology. We've avoided a big war, but we're constantly developing new technology, and who knows? Just around the corner might be some, for instance, some years ago, I was involved in the whole nanotechnology thing here in Norway. And people were talking about the gray goo, that at one point we might develop these machines that were self-replicating, and they would more or less eat everything they came across. And I was thinking, yeah, well, that might be the answer. Who knows? We would think nuclear weapons are the worst we can do. I mean, humans are really, really good at inventing bad things.
Yeah,
and one day someone will make a black hole in CERN and it will eat us all.
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah, right.
that I can definitely say is not going to happen, because we if you can make, well, there are lots of arguments about why that's not going to happen. And one of them is we did think of it. You know, I mean, it's not surprisingly we thought. So there are those statistical studies done with the fact that cosmic rays that are bombarding the Earth all the time are energies far in excess of anything that we can generate at the Large Hadron Collider. So we know it's not like black holes, but we know that in high energy particle collisions do not destroy things, because nature is bombarding us with very high energy particle collisions all the time. We're still here. And that's actually, the analysis was done. So there is, it's not just saying the words, that you can do analysis. We have measurements of that. So not only the theoretical considerations, but also actual measurement tell us that we're okay. That's the least of our worries. I'd focus, you said, on atomic bombs, bioweapons, you know, those threats. I think that, I always think that, you know, people say, you know, in a violent universe, I get asked this a lot, you know, what do you think, what are you most worried about? Is it, you know, the cometary impact on the Earth or something like that? And of course, we should worry about those things. But ultimately, I think it's human stupidity.
Yeah. That's also why.
Applause.
But it's a very good point, because at the moment we have people who are talking about, for instance, establishing human colonies on Mars to create a backup civilization, which is in a sense, yeah, that might be a good thing. And then you think that, but the main problem with moving humans to Mars isn't that we won't leave nuclear weapons behind, because we have the knowledge to build them there. We actually need a lot of nuclear power plants on Mars. And everything that makes us behave terribly towards one another and towards nature will still be there with us unless we do something about it. Which brings me to something you said, something which was said in the ad, which I really like, which is, Horizons is an optimistic vision of our future if we continue to explore nature with humility. And I really like that word, as you've already expressed it, but I really like that. I mean, the idea that we have to approach nature at the moment we have people who are thinking about industrializing space, right? We have Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. Both of them are thinking about bigging build factories and just send the bulldozers. And at the moment, we're still there that, for instance, Mars is explored as a scientific target. And NASA treats Mars with a lot of respect. And we might be 10, 20 years down the line, we might see, again, McDonald's springing up on Mars, right? And coming back to the thing about humility.
Yeah. It's. I think Mars is very interesting, isn't it? Because at the moment, we're seeing the beginnings of the Mars sample return mission. So the Perseverance rover has taken its primary samples now. And the idea is to get them back to Earth. And the level of what's called planetary protection, so detail, is mind-blowing. It is incredibly complicated, the Mars sample return mission, in order to not contaminate Earth with Mars. And and when you look at that, I've asked people at NASA this, and then you have Elon Musk saying, I'm going to go and land there within the next decade. And you go, well, there seems to be a lack of thought as to exactly which approach are we following here? Are we following the extreme, very careful planetary protection protocols that we have for sample return? Or are we just going to send a load of people up there, as you said, to build hamburger joints on the plate? Which one is it? And it's interesting. I mean, you know, I don't think we've thought through the framework within which we explore the solar system with humans yet.
At the moment, we're basically waiting to see if this vision of the reusable starship, right, a rocket that might transform space travel as we know it, might be able to send people to the moon and to Mars at a much lower cost and much more efficiently than we do today. And again, it seems like so many times in human history, when we are faced with advanced science and technology, and all advanced technology is based in very good science, we tend to not stop and take a pause and think, what are we actually doing? A couple of years ago, we had one of our guests was, she's a space ethicist. And one of the few, I mean, space ethics is a subject among philosophers. She's a philosopher, Andrea Ove, very, very bright woman. And she took her master's degree in space ethics. And I think it's a really interesting, they ask some really interesting questions, not just about as you say, protection, planetary protection, but also about sort of what is the universe, and does, for instance, Mars, the landscape of Mars, does it have an intrinsic value in itself? I mean, Mars is a beautiful planet on its own. And do we have the right, or should we at least discuss transforming, terraforming Mars? And I think that's an interesting conversation to have preferably before we go.
Yeah, it is. My provocative reply. So this is for people that don't understand what the purpose, for the purposes of debate, because obviously I'm on Twitter as well. So you say anything at all and people think you really mean it, right?
Yeah.
So let me say to your listeners, this is it for the purposes of debate. So I do think that civilizations, let's assume there's only one in the Milky Way galaxy at the moment. And it's a good assumption. Let's proceed on that basis. And as I said, let's assume this is where meaning comes from. So meaning is a property of things like humans, right? So then you could argue that a place that's devoid of life is a place that's devoid of meaning.
Yeah.
And therefore doesn't have any intrinsic value, you could argue. I could make a strong argument that consciousness, yeah, whatever it is the most valuable physical property of the universe. Mm. And everything else pales into insignificance. Yeah. And so therefore, you know, if we're going to go and mine the asteroid belt, if there's nothing there, even if there are, you could even push it, you could just say even there are microbes there, you could push it and say, well, that's meaningless as well, because, you know, they're not thinking great thoughts or bringing meaning to it. So it's a very interesting area where you can be really provocative and really push it. And then so the ultimate, if you go down that road and think that civilizations are the most valuable thing, then you would just sign the mining certificates.
You would. And that might, yeah. And that might be okay. Or as I said, we probably should have a conversation about it. I also think that this is partly a sort of a Norwegian way of seeing things, because we love our mountains in Norway, even when there's nothing on them. We love sort of the way nature looks, and we love experiencing nature, not necessarily with a lot of life around us. I mean, again, you have the sky, you have the mountains, you have the air, the clouds. And so you have philosophers in Norway as well who's talked about the intrinsic value of something that's not really alive or has the potential to develop or following the laws of evolution or even have an intelligence. So I'm not necessarily saying that it's right, but I do think that we should be having the conversation and as you say, approach it with humility to realize that.
One thing I would say is that the Earth is, there's a different argument here, isn't there?
And
because actually this is one system, this planet, and the idea that you can sort of remove a little bit, as you said, let's imagine if you melt the ice caps, for example. If we melt the ice caps, then the whole system is in trouble as an extreme point. So I think the Earth, the argument for being extremely careful about all natural systems, ecosystems, and so on Earth is overwhelmingly powerful. There's no doubt about that, because we live in an extremely interconnected system that we don't fully understand. And even if you took the view that the most valuable thing was human civilization, even if you took that position, then in order to support it, you need the rest as well.
And of course, there is an argument to be made, and actually Jeff Bezos has made that he gave a lecture a few years ago where he more or less said that he's aware that sooner or later you will hit some real physical limits. We're already hitting them when we have, you can't have unlimited growth in a closed system, which the Earth in many ways is. So he said, okay, let's move it out into space. That might be a solution. And you have some science fiction writers as well that have imagined a future Earth, which is more or less turned back to nature, rewilding, and humans have moved out into space and they live in big orbital stations like the ones you imagined in the 1970s, O'Neill cylinders, which is actually, that's a very good, again, counter-argument. I mean, because when Jeff Bezos talks about building rotating huge stations in space, I mean, he's basically, we can't say that vacuum has intrinsic value, can we? I mean, there has to be a limit somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, he said to me, I'm name dropped again, but he said to me.
Whoops. Once,
he said he wanted to zone the Earth residential.
Yeah, right.
Move the industry off into space where the resources and power is.
Yeah.
Solar power.
Yeah. And basically, and then you can have all the economic growth you want, except, of course, I think the ultimate limit, would you say it's right to say that the ultimate limit of economic growth is actually the speed of light? I mean, you can't necessarily grow faster than the speed of light.
Yeah. That's true.
I've said that to economists, and they look at me like I'm crazy. But I say, no, I'm just an astronomer.
But anyway. welcome to Romkapsel, the space podcast that also talks about economics and economic
We talk
growth.
About everything. And also, yeah. Actually, after our last episode, we had a couple of guests who are actually working on making fertilizer from lunar regolith on behalf of ESA, which is a really interesting subject in itself. And our listener who said, thank you for making this super nerdy episode, because it got a bit nerdy. Nils Johan, I think we can safely say that we are following up with another super nerdy episode, right?
Oh, definitely.
Will they
definitely
be happy? Definitely. They will be so happy. And again, remember, people, when are you on stage in Oslo? You are April
the 29th.
March.
March
Sorry.
29th.
Oh, yeah, so 8 days.
It's just a few days away when recording this.
And I was checking just before we went online, and there are still tickets left, so you can still book, I think. And it's in Oslo Spektrum, as you said. And we've hardly touched on anything you talk about, because there are so many other questions.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like I said, I'll certainly come back, because we have to do one in the studio.
Yeah, we are definitely hoping to see you in Oslo.
Yeah, I have pages full of notes that we never got to.
Yeah, well, we'll do it again.
Du har hørt en podcast fra Podplay. En enklere måte å høre podcast på. Last ned appen Podplay eller se podplay.no.